Hi, this is Cheryl. Anybody else on?
Dang.
Anybody else?
A little
okay.
bit early.
Really? Okay. My watch is fast again.
The PC just turned 8. Hi, who joined?
Rick Wasner.
Hey, Rick. Stagg and Cheryl are on. We're waiting for Ken. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good.
Good.
Did you guys get any of the rain from Irene?
No. We're about 400 to 500 miles away from the coast, so.
Yeah, well, I just didn't know if any of it came that far west.
Yeah, we actually could have used some.
Oh, okay.
But we had a beautiful day while they were having the storms. Now we're getting dry, but the eastern part of the state definitely got clobbered.
Mm-hmm.
You all were having terrifically, I guess, hot weather now. Is that finally broken?
Yeah, it's we're getting down to where it's mostly in the low 80s, but. Well, I guess Thursday, Friday, we're supposed to be back up in 90 with humidity again, but then it's supposed to get back down in the 80s, low 80s again. So, it isn't so bad.
That still sounds pretty awful. We're a bit more accustomed to, you know, if it's over 80, people bitch.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, it's been a pretty hot summer. I mean, it's...
Yeah, we're fortunate even...
Who joined? This is Cheryl.
Hi, this is Sudie.
Hey, welcome, Sudie.
Thanks.
Ken hasn't yet joined us. We've got Stagg, Rich Wasner, myself, you, and...
And.
As soon as Ken joins us, we'll get launched. I just... Anyhow, I'll do a little bit of an introduction later.
Did folks get the charts that Ken sent us today?
Yes.
I did.
Okay. Good.
And speaking of which, I've got my computer out. That's the good part. Now I've got to get the charts up.
I'm trying to get mine to go from one to the next.
That sounds like can I know
here? What is the secret on getting it to move? Let's see.
Boy, these pictures are awesome.
Okay. Maybe we just go, yes, we just go down. That's simple enough. All right. I'm good now.
Yes.
I'm trying to make it go sideways like some programs do. It wants to go up and down. That will do it.
Well, I know Ken knows about it. Evidenced by the fact that he sent the charts out. I know.
Cheryl, while you're on the phone, I think we're full for the newbie clinic. And one more entry today. And Sarah says she may have a couple more students. And I think with that, we're at our limit.
And then some, yeah. Who joined, please?
This is Ken.
Hey, welcome.
Hey, how are you?
The man in charge.
We are ready to launch.
Good deal. And you got the slides okay?
Yes. Thank you so much.
I think everybody on the phone said they'd gotten them, or at least
good.
When we did the poll. I'm not sure who's since they had.
No problem. Those were the ones that I picked out of the Sarah lecture and stuff that toward the end. We were talking originally about when to move up, and the whole conversation at that point was, what can we use for parameters to monitor how horses are doing and look at that. And that's, I'm assuming everybody's online, ready to go ahead?
Yep.
Okay. Well, that's where all this stuff came out of, the idea of what could we use physiologically to monitor how the horses were doing and what can we use to decide, are we overtraining, undertraining, are we ready to come back for another big ride and so forth, and got looking at what was available from the standpoint of hematological statistics, blood work and so forth to look at that, and that's kind of what led us to profile a mood state. An interesting side note, I've been dealing with the trainer of Shackelford, the horse that run the Preakness, Dale Romans, and he's an old school guy, but he's been collecting a boatload of data from blood work and so forth, but he has no, and I was talking to him about it, and he said, well, after the season is over, let's go ahead and get together and see what we can figure out in terms of looking at it, because he's got no information on what to do with all that. So he's got tons of data sitting around with different blood parameters and no idea to figure out what to do with it. And when I reviewed the information, the number of slides they're looking at, the LDH and SGOT and bile acids and a bunch of other things in terms of what people have done in the past to try to figure out what we can look at for horse parameters and look at that to gauge fitness, gauge how horses recover from work. That's all what the standard is. And of all of that stuff, the parameter that's the closest to measuring and being able to say anything about how horses are doing is glutathione peroxidase. And there's a
what?
Point on that slide.
I'm sorry.
Pardon? The glutathione peroxidase.
Run that slide just real slow.
Okay. Glutathione peroxidase. It's the slide that's got the picture of the weather vane with snow, which is from here in my yard. The slide that's got that horse weather vane with the snow on top of it. And it's not really important to understand exactly what it is, because it's not something you're going to use. It's a very expensive test. It has something about an 82% predictive value for where those horses are in terms of fitness, but it's hard to do. It has to be done while you're exercising the horse or at track side or at ride side. It's a very expensive test to run. The blood does not stay stable very long, so you can't take samples and then go back to the lab the next day or the later at the end of a ride and stuff. It's got to be run pretty quickly, so you almost have to have a lab right there or be doing it where you're doing the exercise. So, again, it's an 82% predictive value, but it's very non-usable. That's what led me to the profile and mood states test. And originally these tests were done for looking at more behavioral responses in people, looking at depression, anxiety, some of the other tests, and the profile mood states was a means of getting at some of that information to figure out how people were doing. Then the sports world got a hold of it, and when I gave that talk, I put the statistic in there about how many studies were done in a short period of time looking at profile mood states. Well, that's gone up. I think it had 100 and I don't have the slides in front of me, but 100 and some odd published articles in that time frame. Well, it's now up to 258 because they've added a bunch of new profile mood state articles where PLMS was used with athletes or exercising, doing samples during that to try to figure out which of those profile mood states could predict something about performance. And of the 258 published articles, this reviewing from 1971 to 1998, so there's newer ones even after that, out of 258, 226 were data-based. So it wasn't just people going ahead and asking some questions and sort of fuzzy science about how do you feel or how are things going. They were pretty good scientific studies with some data behind them to try to look at what we could use for performance. And in people, it really seems like that is one of the more prominent things that can be utilized.
Ken?
Hello?
I think we just lost Ken.
Can you hear me? Hello?
You're back?
You're there, but you're sounding more like you're at the bottom of a well.
Okay, let's see if I'm – is
okay.
That any better?
That's better now.
That's
okay,
good.
All right. I have no idea what that was. But I pulled an article, and I'm that's probably just putting the phone in my other hand as I'm sifting through some papers here. I pulled an article, and they're starting to quote the profile mood states as an actual diagnostic test. So it's interesting that in the lexicon, they're starting to look at POMS as a diagnostic test, or almost as much as any of the other laboratory tests that got done. So it's gaining a little bit more credence and stuff as people are going along with it. And the biggest thing about this is that the studies that were done with the Australian swim teams and a couple of other elite swim teams, the biggest study, they went ahead just to review, and they were looking at elite swimmers, and this was an Australian national swim team which had something, I think, eight out of the top placed 10 swimmers in the world. And they looked at them as they were training for the national championships, and they were looking at profile mood states and trying to figure out, given the testing with the profile mood states, which athletes would do the best. And there's the profile mood states, simply put, a bunch of questions to get at how are people training, how are people feeling, how are they eating and drinking and sleeping, and all those other things that go into deciding how well you're doing with a with an exercise program. Are you looking forward to your workouts? Do you feel tired and sore after your workouts? How is your rest and how is your appetite? Simple things. And they found that the predictive value for doing those kind of deals with athletes was 72%. So it was interesting that, you know, 82% with glutathione peroxidase, which is the best laboratory predictor that we can as far as training and fitness, and 70-some-odd% with these kind of questions. And I thought, well, can we do this with horses? And the reason I thought about it is if you go back and talk to old trainers, a lot of trainers will tell you that they gauge how hard to work a horse and who's fit and who's ready. And this is mostly from the thoroughbred world, based on the same things. How well is the horse eating? Is the horse diving into its oats, leaving a little bit of oats? How did the horse train? And that comes back from exercise riders. Well, he's pulling my arms out today. He's really fit. He's ready. He wants more work. Or, you know, he's lagging a little bit. He didn't keep up with the other horses that were training partners. How did they sleep? And that's where the information from the grooms came in. You know, he seems to be fit and ready. He's anxious. His stall was all turned up. The simple things that you, as horse owners, probably have a better feel for, those are the same things that they look for at profile mood state. But they're just, you know, verbally with people. With horses, we've got to look at the clues. Now, we tried to do this at the Biltmore, and I have a feeling that we didn't get a whole lot of differentiation out of it, probably because of one of two things, and this is what I wanted to discuss and see if you guys had other thoughts too. I think the questions perhaps may be a little bit basic. We asked whether or not the horse had been training well, whether they slept well, whether they ate well, and that well may not be a good enough answer. We probably need to have more specifics because we can't get the subjective evaluation that people might give you. You know, they can say, somebody can tell you, hey, I'm dreaming a little bit more, or I was a little bit restful. We don't know that unless we can measure that with horses. And how many of us actually watch how well our horses sleep? Is it the same amount of time as usual, or less, or more? As far as eating, well, you know, there's a performance aspect of it. They eat what we give them, whereas people, athletes, have more choice to that. So, you know, we may be regulating to the point where we can't differentiate. So I think there's a lot more that we may be able to do, but we have to be more specific in perhaps the questions we ask and the way we go about trying to get that information. And that's kind of what I've been thinking of. Because it's such a huge predictive value, human athletes, I have to feel that there's also some way that we can utilize that in horses. It just may stretch us in terms of how we can get at that information. And that's kind of where all this stuff is starting.
You know, I think, Ken, the other problem we had at Biltmore in terms of predictive, you know, looking for correlations between performance and the measurements we were taking on the blood work side. Certainly I saw this, you know, on the progressive recovery side, is the weather conditions, you know, everything
sure.
was too favorable.
Right. It may not have stressed them out enough to be able to do that.
Yeah, we didn't see a lot of stress. There were a couple of horses where I think the progressive recoveries were giving us some indication, but in
right.
general, we had a very high completion rate, which was great. But you know,
going back to the Australian study too, if you look at elite swimmers, I mean, there's no weather factor. Everybody's swimming in a pool, so none of that goes on with it.
Yeah.
And they were looking at for a longer period of time as they trained to try to figure out, based on the results going into that, who is going to place where the placements were going to be. And they were pretty accurate in doing that. And it may be that we one weekend, in the sense that these horses live on adrenaline, they live on epinephrine, when they get to a show or a ride, they're going to be up anyway. And maybe a lot of the subtle variations are dampened out by the horses placing in that environmental setting. If we were to look at them at home and see how they were working or training at home, we might get more normal variation because the horse is going to show a little bit more in an environment that they don't need to have all that adrenaline in their system, essentially the flight or fight kind of response. They're going to be at their peak with a bunch of horses in that sort of setting no matter what happens. So that may you know, you may be able to use more of this stuff to say, okay, I think he's ready. I think this is the ride for him, for me to push him, as opposed to trying to get that information at the ride. So, but that's just a thought. I'm not sure. This has never been worked out before, and as far as I know, there's been no profile mood state looking at predictive athletic performance done in horses. It's been done in every single athlete I can think of, from tug-of-war championships in Tobago to, you know, people that ride horses and so forth, and certainly swimming and football and a bunch of other stuff, but not in horses. And I don't know that it can't be. Go ahead.
Now, one of the things that I was also chewing on this was, okay, you've got different distances. In other words, you're asking different horses for different levels of exertion.
Correct.
And how do you, what types of differentiators should you be looking for? Yeah, this is like looking probably 20 years out or something like this, but what types of differentiators would you anticipate looking for that would say your horse is ready for 20 miles, 50 miles, 100 miles?
Well, in terms of profile mood states, I don't even think we're there yet, because I think that that's going to be hard to do. And again, it's going to have to be horses that are on the elite level of that. So looking at horses that are ready to do a slow, easy 50, I don't think you're going to find anything at all that's going to differentiate those horses, because you're not pushing them hard enough. But if you're going ahead and pushing at the upper levels and you're trying to say, okay, I'm ready to do fast tethers, or I'm ready to really push it at higher levels, even at 50 or 100, maybe we can find that out a little bit. That may be differentiating. But you're right. If the exertion level and the effort level is not high enough, these things may not come into play. In the same way that if you were to do blood values on things that we really know about, looking at LDH, SGOT, muscle enzyme values, or looking at bile liver enzymes that will show you how quickly a horse can come back and exercise maximally after having a hard exercise, you may not find that unless they worked hard enough. And that certainly is true in thoroughbreds or in anything else we've been able to measure. If they're not pushing hard enough, those values aren't high enough to differentiate. And that may be part of it, too. It may have to be just the elite level, which it may not be of benefit then from that standpoint for normal stuff. But what everybody's been looking for is kind of this holy grail. What do we look at in terms of blood parameters to find out if we're doing the right job? Are we getting our electrolytes right? Are we pushing too hard? Are we overtraining or undertraining? And the thought was, well, if you could tap into some of this PLMS stuff without having to actually do the blood work and get something that's correlated well above 65%, that, you know, it's still probably worthwhile.
Yeah, I'm particularly interested in, you know, how can we use it to measure overtraining, because I think a lot of people, I think that's a bigger problem in this sport than maybe a lot of us realize.
Sure. Absolutely. We've all grown up on the idea that horses have to do lots and lots of miles, but it may not necessarily be true. You may have to do, you know, enough miles in the right order at the right time to get them to peak correctly. When do you back off, and when do you give them a little bit of time so that they're the freshest when you're pointing toward a ride? We all know that the foreign elite teams, they're pushing one particular horse for one particular ride. They're much more focused in on having the right horse in the right position for this particular ride or this particular competition, whether it be preliminaries to the Worlds or the World Cup or to Dubai or whatever. It's not a question of having the same horse be consistent through a number of different rides like we do more in this country. And in that case, these parameters make more sense, because you're looking at where the horse is and how much you have to focus for that one particular time. Those values, as far as some of the values that are on those slides, those are pretty well set forward. And I think you could make a good case of being able to utilize some of those blood values to see whether the muscle enzymes are coming down quickly enough. Are they staying too high in terms of LDH or SGOT, showing that you're not getting repair of muscle? Are you getting stale in terms of the hematocrit? That's another good indicator in some of the red blood cell indices that the horses are simply overtrained and you're not getting that peak value, you're not getting a buildup. Those curves and those studies are more suggestive of being able to look at it that way, but that's going to be one horse for one particular time. And my guess is, you know, talk to you guys because you're the ones that ride all the time. When you're looking to overtrain, would it be beneficial? And could you focus on one particular ride or one particular time point? Because otherwise, you can't have a horse fit for a whole season and then question overtraining or undertraining, because you're going to have peaks and valleys. There's no way to keep them trained and fit for that long a time frame.
You know, and what I'm thinking is that, you know, we sort of, you've got signs of good performance here on this chart, sort of turning it around and saying, you know, these are signs of that you've either been overtraining or overcompeting, either
correct.
Way. That, you know,
right.
It's, you know, if we can get more systematic approach to that, then, you know, people can back off before they take that horse into competition and get the breakdown that causes, you know, the horse to have a year off or be retired or what have you.
And we're working on a mindset. Do you think we can change the mindset for people that they'd be comfortable being able to do that and get away from the, boy, I've got rides coming up, I need to be on my horse, I need to be doing lots of miles?
I think for a lot of people, if they better understood that, good. Not for everybody, but I think most people in the sport, you know, not trying to compete at the elite level. I mean, I think we now are seeing for the few, you know, the people who want to make the team to the North American or the world or whatever,
right,
are sort of getting in the mindset of that's all they peak for. Now, I do think even training for that, I think one of the major problems the U.S. made going into Kentucky was they overtrained the horses.
Sure.
But, you know, that was, well, let's not even go there other than I think that was a major mistake if the horses were overtrained. But it wasn't because the people were overcompeting. It was because
right.
people were being told to overtrain their horses.
Train them, yeah.
But I think for most ARC riders who are looking to campaign for a season or for many seasons, if they knew there were certain indicators that said it's time to back off, they would do that and wait, you know, and compete, you know, 3 weeks later or something.
Right. So, well, and that also means that you could use competitions as trainings if you're willing to say, okay, I want to ride, and that's what most people want to do. I want to be out there. I want to ride. But this week or this month, my ride needs to be a slow 50 in this range, and I can use that as a training ride, not mess up my desire to get out there and ride, but not push the horse so much to overtrain it. So those things could be built in if somebody wanted to do that system and say, all right, I'm going to peak here, but I want to ride here and here in the middle of those peaks, but I know I'm going to have to use that ride as just a training or just a conditioning and stay well within where my horse is supposed to be at that point. And that could easily be done, and that might make people more willing to do it because it's not like you have to hold off on being able to go and ride, which is what most people want to do.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point, is that, and there are people, and Cheryl and I to a certain extent have, you know, used 50s just as training rides to get ready for 100 or even done a slow 100 to get ready for fast 100. So I think that's a great point. I'm looking at your list here, and I think, you know, one of them, observing the horses, you know, how they're eating and their sort of overall mood is something that, you know, all of us can try to do, although a lot of that, I think, is intuition and experience, which is part of the challenge. You know, it's one thing if you're like these old thoroughbred trainers, right? They're training, I don't know how many horses at a time, but, you know, they've got orders of magnitude more experience than most of us will ever have with
right.
horses. Although I guess you all as veterinarians probably, I don't know whether you get to see, do you get to see the same horse often enough to get a feel, you know, if you come into a barn and with their horses?
The track guys do, I guess, because they're getting onto the track and they're going to the same barns on a regular basis. And again, I've learned a boatload of stuff from one particular client that I've picked up over the last 2 or 3 years. It's a cutting horse barn, and you know, I go there every Wednesday. They go cutting every weekend, and on Wednesday we try to fix everything again. So I'm seeing these horses once a week throughout the entire season. There may be a month or so that they're not doing a whole lot, but otherwise I'm seeing them repetitively. And it makes it so much easier to see, and that sport's fairly comparable because you have times where you have securities that you need to peak for, And then you have times where you can afford to let the horses get some rest. You can let them lose a little muscle. You can let them go ahead and get some psychological rest, and then you have to peak up again. And it's all about, with these guys, it's all about getting a check. And they go that weekend, and my trainer says, hey, you know, anytime that they write me more checks than I write them, that's a good weekend, and that's what they're shooting for. So we do a lot of that. We set up a whole year and look at the calendar and plan out our rest periods and stuff. And there's a couple of good articles in Endurance News about rest and putting rest into a program. And you know, one of my favorite quotes is that good trainers plan on the rest programs and bad trainers have it forced upon them, because if you don't build rest in your program, they're going to break down and you're going to have to rest them. So you might as well go look at the year. And I think it does take looking at a whole year and deciding when you're going to use your rest periods and how that's going to factor in. So, yeah, you do get a chance to see often enough. You see your horses on a day-to-day basis, so you kind of know. Sometimes I think the rider loses the big perspective, and the ancillary people, your vet, your trainer, perhaps your chiropractic or whoever else you're using, they see the big stuff and don't see the day-to-day. And it takes both of that to put the program together.
Yeah, that's a excellent point that – as you say, you need to consult with your vet and whoever else works with your horse regularly and see what they're...
Talk to your farrier and stuff, and you know that, hey, this horse has more issue in this time of the year. We at least have some problems here or this, or we know we have some allergies that's going to take a while to adjust to in the spring as we go into that, or this horse does better winter, this horse does better in summer, and factor all that into the decisions you make and choose your training plan accordingly based on the other parameters that have to be enforced on it, because of not only stuff that goes on the horse, but let's face it, it's a realistic world. We don't have enough people that do this professionally or can do it professionally that they don't have other factors in there. When you have heavy work schedules, when you can't train as much, other things go into this. But it should all be there. I would say that the best thing you could possibly do is get one of those big calendars where you can see the months at a glance, a big old schedule, and come into it with your sheet from... These are my work requirements. These are my family requirements. These are my health requirements. These are weather requirements, and put it all together and have a big master plan. That would, to me, be the best way to go about looking at conditioning, performing, and getting horses to either peak at a particular time or peak at a number of times that would coincide to the rides that you really want to do the best at.
Yeah.
Just in your experience, how many peaks do you anticipate a horse able to, in effect, achieve during a 12-month period?
Now, assuming that the horse is fit to start?
Yeah.
I think you could probably look to peak, four times maybe in a 12-month period and so forth, so that you could really bring it to a peak and then drop off, let the horse relax a little bit, and then peak again and come back up. And by peaking, I'm assuming doing a competitive – competitive 100.
Mm-hmm.
And if you, in our competitive 50, I think that's probably realistic. You can probably throw, another one or two 50s in there, because the recovery time wouldn't be as hard for that. You don't need to go as much downtime. And again, you don't want to lose muscle mass, but what you do want to do is you want to let the muscle heal enough, and you want to go ahead and let the enzymes drop a bit and back off some, so that then you can start another cycle of peaking up. If you try to stay at the upper level of the preparedness or fitness, you can't hold it very long, because then you get stale and things start falling off, and I don't think the body functions that well. Could you do two 50s in a month if you really wanted to? Sure. But then after that point, you really have to let off and let the horse drop down a little bit to bring the peak back up and let the body clear. So that's where I think it depends on what you want to do and what your goals are.
How long, if you turn the horse out for rest, and let's assume they're in a five acre field or something. In other words,
right?
They've got plenty of room to run around. Ideally, it's not even flat; it's rolling or whatever. How long? I know it's radically different from people, but how long do they, in a field like that, would they go and lose minimal conditioning so that you could, bring them right back into a competition?
From what we've been able to see, most fit horses that don't get anything other than turnout will still be able to keep relatively decent fitness for 45 days. 60 days, they start dropping off. So 30 to 45 days, you can probably keep them where they are. After that point, you're going to start seeing some pretty reasonable drop off to the point where you can measure it and you'd have to come back. But again, when I'm talking about rest, I mean, I think that we have to reevaluate that too, because I don't know that horses need total turnout rest as opposed to, you know, significant changes from what they've been doing. So even 2 exercise bouts a week with, you know, with pasture rest and stuff in between that is still sufficient to keep exercise and fitness up, so you don't get that big drop off. But if you're doing something that's different enough, whether it be psychologically different enough for the horse, and that can be terrain, that can be, you know, whatever you decide to do with it, and something that is different enough to use different muscles, different parts of the horse, you can still maintain fitness and also achieve rest. The hard part is most of the things that endurance riders do are what everybody else does for rest. So my jumper clients will do, you know, lots of trails and lots of stuff outside of rings and stuff, and that's restful for their horses. I have heard from some endurance people that they've, you know, tried doing some team penning and some other stuff that requires a little bit more short work, not quite the long sustained distance work, and horses like that because it's psychologically a little bit different. They keep them in exercise, and again, it works a little bit of the fast twitch fibers, which we never spend much attention working on. And we talked briefly that that's probably another topic down the road. How do you condition speed, and what should we be doing differently to put speed work into horses and reactivity and stuff? So maybe you decide, okay, when I'm going to be taking my 45 days of rest, I might do a light ride twice a week, and then I may throw in one section where I, you know, gather up cattle, or I do something different that requires a little bit more short-term stuff. I may take him and stick him ball some polo if he's comfortable with something like that, or do something that causes the horse to exercise, but that's just a little bit different from what he had been doing. Because they can tolerate that. They don't need, none of the studies show that a horse needs to have full and complete rest, and that's probably true for people as well. There are variations in the psychological makeup of certain horses, and you guys probably have all run into these, where some thrive on the work and they like the companionship and the bonding with people, and don't do well if they're not handled and paid attention to. So you have to be innovative to what you come up with those guys, but they don't do well just sitting in a field without that. And there's some horses that just simply want to be left alone for a while, and they do better with that. Again, it comes down to knowing your horse and stuff. And again, I think the PLMS could fit into that too. Which horses don't eat well and which horses seem more agitated when they get more off time that doesn't include doing stuff, and which horses seem to perk up and do better when they have those kind of periodic, you know, interactions with riders and so forth. So that would fit into that differentiation between those types of horses as well.
Is there any rule of thumb once they've been out, say that you're had them off for, you know, 40, 45 days, how rapidly do they come back? I mean, you know, is 3 workouts enough to...
Well, different things come back quickly, or different things come back at different times. Essentially, if you look at ligament and tendon strength and stability as one group, muscle strength as another group, and then cardiovascular fitness as another group, you can get muscle back a lot quicker than cardiovascular fitness. And tendon and ligament, because it doesn't have a lot of blood supply and because it tends to take a longer time to build up, that comes back even slower. So the long, slow distance part of it has been always something to keep tendons and ligaments fit. That's why I think if you can rest them but not lose that, and, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 workouts of minimal intensity, varying what you do weekly, are still enough to keep a horse doing that. And yet you can factor that in some rest so that you're not pushing the muscles and you're not pushing the other things that do need to rest. If you keep the ligaments and tendons in pretty decent shape, then the other stuff comes back a lot quicker. And you can usually, so let's say a horse has been off 45 days, you know, really from that standpoint, 2 weeks of more intense training can bring a horse back to relative fitness, to the point where then you can go on with a program even after he's been sitting relatively idle if you just do enough periodically to keep the tendons and ligaments in decent shape.
And this is another one of those almost trick questions. I know where Stike's going on this somewhat, and I'm going to sort of throw the monkey wrench in it.
Yep.
What factors does the age of the horse play into all that?
If it was a straight line, you would say as the horse ages, it takes longer for it to come back. but you do have those outliers. And I don't know that you can necessarily say that there's going to be as much drop off. The horse in general does not, I don't think, in anything I've been able to read, and certainly what I've seen, horse doesn't necessarily fit that parameter, because we'll have 20-year-old horses in the Olympics that, you know, you look at them cardiovascularly, you look at their performance level, they're as fit as, you know, 5 or 6-year-olds that haven't gone through any kind of a program. They're just hanging out in the pasture. So, and maybe that is more correlative to what's going on with people nowadays too, because we've got better quality nutrition, better quality exercise physiologists that are, you know, come up with programs. Certainly across the board, you're seeing, you know, professional athletes that are, you know, holding up at a level that was unprecedented 20 years ago, given their age. There is going to be more wear and tear on the joints. We know that as a fact. There's no way around that. And the older you age as an athlete, that usually indicates you've had a lot more miles. So those are going to be more wear and tear. And that begs the question, you know, those horses probably don't need and shouldn't have as much true rest, because then you lose muscle conditioning and you lose tendon and ligament conditioning, which makes them have to rely more on joint surfaces. Because when you fatigue your muscles first, your ligaments and tendons next, and the joints are the last thing to go. And if you think about going out for a run, you know, you're up on the tips of your feet, you're running along, and we start getting tired, and you don't have that muscle ability and you don't have the ligaments and tendons, you're just slapping those feet down. And the end of a run, if you're really tired, your form is poor, and that's when you're going to have more trouble. Older horses that have joint problems, the fitter they stay, the less wear and tear on their joints, and the better they're going to hold up. So those would be horses that I would think you'd really work on keeping a core program, so that they don't get to the point where, you know, they have the big ups and downs. They should stay more on a sort of a level key. But those aren't the horses usually that you're working on peaking it, you know, for elite events, I guess, as they get more and more age. If that's the case, you would say, all right, you know, pick an event a year for an older horse and be ready for that event, and then give him, you know, whatever extended time. But I'm not a big fan of letting older horses really get out of much in terms of fit shape, because I think it does more damage to them overall because of the other things at age. Cardiovascularly, we don't see a whole lot of that. We're not looking at the atherosclerosis. We're not looking at the ligament degeneration and stuff. And as far as the heart muscle goes, you know, we've seen older horses on treadmill tests that have ejection fraction coefficients that are just as good as younger horses. So that doesn't seem to be a huge problem as long as there's no pathology. But joint-wise, we know for sure that that's going to be a problem with age and the miles that these older horses have.
Let me throw this a little bit over. Rich Wiesner, do you have any questions?
I'd be interested in, you know, anybody else's take on this too. I mean, like I said, throwing this stuff out and trying to look at this aspect of it, it's not something we normally think about in horses, although we do it intuitively anyway.
Yeah, and I also want to ask Sudie, he's got any questions.
No, I don't have questions so far, but it's all interesting to me because everything you're saying lines up with what I know about endurance training for humans and the whole concept of peaking and looking at a calendar and, you know, mapping it all out. I mean, that's what human endurance athletes have been doing for years, and so it just makes sense. And I don't think we do that. I don't think many of us, you know, really take the time to think that way as much as we could with our horses.
Yeah, it does take a much more long-term view, and it takes a lot more discipline and planning, I guess, because it's a beautiful weather and you've got a nice ride and you show up and it's like, okay, I'll go a little bit more, but that may not be in your plan. And for overall success, you have to stick to the plan.
Right. The other thing that I would just say as someone who is at Biltmore and part of the profile is that it was very hard in the middle of the race and with all everything that's going on, you know, when the questions were asked about the mood and, you know, how did they, you know, just all the different questions, it was very easy to just kind of give the answers.
General answers.
Yeah, that you thought you wanted to have. And
right.
What you said that I thought was really on target is that, you know, the clues are so much more subtle in the race environment because the horses are hyped up and they're there and they're doing their job and they know that and hopefully they like that. And so the clues just get so much more subtle, it seems to me. And
maybe we should ask more questions about those types of things leading up to getting to Biltmore. How was the horse eating, you know, this week? Did the horse seem to work when, and, you know, really well in your last workout, or did you feel you had a kind of a weaker workout? Although when you ask a rider, that's my other question about it. I'm getting the impression that elite human athletes are not necessarily the sharpest knives in the drawer, because, well, the profile moves test, originally there were 64 questions and they whittled it down to about 8 or 9 because they couldn't get any answers out of these athletes. By the time, if they were asking too much, it all kind of got jumbled together, and the simpler they made it, the better it seemed to be. The other thing is, too, if I'm an elite athlete, I'm thinking, and again, correct me if anybody else thinks something different, this is just my thoughts about it. If I'm an elite athlete, am I going to actually go ahead, it's all about positive thinking, am I actually going to go ahead and tell somebody that, yeah, no, I've been, you know, eating really poorly, and I'm really worried about my workouts, and I think I'm going to do really poorly. I don't think that most people do that, and yet they got those kind of responses. So apparently the athletes were way more, less concerned and less overthinking stuff. They just basically let it all hang out and said whatever was going on, because they did get some people that said, geez, you know, I've been sleeping like crap, and I don't feel good, and I didn't feel like eating, and, you know, I had a lousy workout, and I'm worried about this and worried about that. Obviously, those people weren't high on the list to do well. But as a rider, you know, again, and I'm not a rider, so you guys tell me, but if somebody were to ask you, you know, how your horse is doing, what's going on, you wouldn't be at a ride and you wouldn't be getting on if you thought the horse wasn't doing well. So does that cloud your vision, and would you really recognize that, and would it factor into something that you would answer if your horse hadn't been perhaps doing that well? Do you go into a ride entertaining the thoughts that maybe you shouldn't be pushing this horse because last week he wasn't eating well, or he wasn't sleeping well, or do you just go ahead and maybe tune that out and say, I'm making too much of that, he's actually doing fine?
I think you're right on, and I think that's the hard part, is to pay attention to what happened the week before, what happened in the trailer ride, how did they come off the trailer and settle in, how well did they eat and drink, you know, the night before, or the day, you know, if they came 2 days before, what happened right before the ride. I think it's very easy as a rider to convince yourself that those cues don't mean much when they really
right.
mean a lot.
Yeah, it's not in your best interest to go into something like that with a negative attitude, because that permeates everything else. And do we overthink for our horses and say, well, you know, I'm gonna assume everything's good, I'm gonna have a positive attitude, we're gonna ride, and it's gonna be a good day. And how do we get at the specifics? And one of the things that you would normally do in a scientific way would be to test things that don't have a subjective value to it, but profile of mood states, everything's subjective. And we could measure how much the horse is eating and see whether the horse is eating more or less, but in general, they eat what we give them. So if they finish everything up, then we'd have to go ahead and look at how quickly do they finish it up. And does that mean that horse has got a better appetite than somebody who finishes it in 24 hours, but not as, you know, ravenous or not with as much gusto? So getting at that subtleties in a black or white data only type way is tough. And you want the subtleties. You want the perceived idea, boy, the horse, you know, just got out of the stall and we got on the trail and that horse was ready to go. Or, you know, we kind of have to slowly work into it. And once we got going, he was all right, but he wasn't really, you know, just pulling real hard in the beginning and stuff. Or he was pulling too hard. Those subtleties are what PMS is all about. And adapting it to the horse may or may not be a little harder to do. But I go back to the fact that the best correlative thing that we can give you in performance on a blood test gives us about 82%. The PMS, when you can do it with people and get it done right, is 70-something. So that's a huge thing that we could do if we can figure this out. And it's not hard. It doesn't cost anything. And it doesn't, you know, it's non-invasive. So I think it's worth paying more attention to. But we're not there yet.
Ken, one of the ones that is quantitative on your list is heart rate.
Yep.
Are the thoroughbred farms or anything, well, you say heart rate, would that be monitoring the heart rate, say, at a consistent time every day, or is that monitoring the heart rate recover after workouts, or?
Yeah, more specific with workouts to be able to tell, you know, fitness, as you guys are already doing, and I would think that the endurance world is probably ahead of this. You are aware of, working or riding, everybody's got a specific spot in their training loops that they know from here to here, it's either a specific distance, or if I ride this distance after I've been working a bit and I check the heart rate before and after, I can see the heart rate's less than it was 3 weeks ago when I ride that particular distance at a particular pace. Or if I pick up the pace and ride a faster pace over that distance, my rate at the end of that is going down, so I know I'm getting fit. And by being able to do that, heart rate over a set distance or set distance with a set speed and looking at heart rates, you can monitor, are you getting continual improvement? Have you plateaued? Are you regressing? Those are the ways it gets done. And as far as heart rate on the track, I think that they're, you know, kind of scratching that. They want, you know, consistent speed all the time. They're not looking at quote-unquote fitness. They're looking at fitness for particular races for speed. So they're looking mostly heart rate over a specific distance and then trying to crank the speed up so that the rate stays in a working range and they don't go into the overload max, which is going to update the lactic acid. So racehorses, I don't think they have enough of it because they don't put enough bottom on them to really get a feel for what the fitness is, but they certainly can train a lot more speed. And we're seeing more of that, more fitness work in the thoroughbred world, but not quite there. The heart rate thing, you know, you guys are way ahead of being able to figure out, you know, who's fit. And I think that can be used to see whether you're getting, you know, into overtraining. Because if you're not getting improvements, when you start getting a plateau and you're not having any pathology, then, you know, you're hitting a training wall and you need to back off to be able to then come back and push again, or quit with the same distances and start increasing, you know, speed for shorter distances, which would go ahead and increase heart size and heart blood flow and stuff, and then come back and see whether or not you get more improvement with fitness over set distances.
Okay, so it's much more heart rate under training as opposed to your resting heart rate is showing.
Yeah, yeah, and there's too many other variables for that. I think that's just sort of hard to find a particular, and there's so many things that can factor into that and confuse it. So that hasn't been really beneficial for a whole lot.
I guess what is showing to be a very good predictor, which I think is done at rest, is the heart rate variability. But of course, that's
correct.
Not something that can be done by the casual person. That takes
no. And I think that that's going to be a very interesting area, and we'll see what happens with that. There's a lot of stuff being done on that now, and probably some of you have seen things in some of the catalogs and stuff about blood viscosity, and that's another little voodoo science that people are jumping on. There are a couple of companies out there now that are offering to measure blood viscosity and give you values on that. If you go and look at their sites and look at the science, there are a couple of articles about why thick blood causes problems in horses and some studies in people that, you know, monitoring blood viscosity and using that while you monitor training might help, but there's nothing in there that's pertinent to the horse per se, and there's nothing that once they measure your viscosity, there's absolutely nothing they can tell you to do about it, which, you know, there's certainly some things there that can be helpful. And I go back to the fact that almost all the horses in our testing at Biltmore, or a high percentage of them, were dehydrated when they showed up, and I'm not sure I buy that. I mean, I just don't think, knowing some of the horses.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Yeah, I think that's a problem with the parameters. And I talked to a number of people and a lot of the vets that were involved in this, and they swear that their values for normal are correct. And I don't believe that. I just don't buy that their values for normal were horses that were prepared in a similar way and stuff. I think those values come more from the general horse population, and I don't think that they fit with horses, because I had too many horses that came, were dehydrated when they got there, did well, performed well, and recovered and were clinically fine. And I just don't buy that as being normal. I think that the normal for a lot of
people. And I will give you, hang on a second, I will give you one other example of almost something that very, in my own head at least, supports your argument. We brought our horses over there on the morning of Friday.
Right.
And the first blood draw was done 4 hours later, and they were dehydrated.
Yeah,
I don't believe that.
And
I agree.
In our cases, you know, it was a 35-minute trailer ride, so it's not like
right.
We'd.
Yeah.
You know,
I do believe that value in some of the horse population would constitute dehydrated, but I don't believe for these particular horses that constitutes that. And I go back to We all know that the horse sequesters a great proportion of its red blood cells in the spleen. We don't necessarily know that horses that do longer distances, there's not a whole lot in there that says horses that do longer distances sequester 62% and horses that do shorter distances sequester 42%. We don't know anything about that. So it may be that the population that we're looking at has much more variation on what is correct and what's normal than the average healthy sport horse population. Because when you say sport horse, well, what sport? How old? How trained? How fit? And we don't have answers for that. We have a generalized category. So I saw too much variation there and too many horses that had no issues that were clinically, according to those values, dehydrated, and I'm not buying it. So that's another thing we need to look at, actually. And that's where the dehydration goes to the viscosity. You dehydrate, your blood gets thicker, and blood thickness will increase viscosity and then leads to all the problems accordingly to that. But you know, you have to be able to say what is thick blood for this horse and versus thick blood for that horse.
And this was dehydration measured both by the blood work and by the electronic
right.
Yeah, so yep. Both of those were correlated, saying the horses were dehydrated, but they weren't performed. That's interesting.
And I totally had the same experience that you guys had. I mean, we had a 3-hour trailer ride. And our horses did great, came off the trailer, started, you know, drank well. I mean, it was sort of a dream, you know, get ready for the race situation. And when I got the results back and saw they were dehydrated, I was like, well, I don't really know what I can do, you know.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Well,
I feel better hearing that.
That's interesting.
Sure. Well, and when we were doing that urine study and looking at some of the specific gravity of urine and stuff, you'd think, okay, if a horse was dehydrated before it started the ride, then certainly we wouldn't be getting some really dilute urine in the first loop. A dehydrated horse isn't by nature going to be going ahead and produce dilute urine. It's going to be conserving water.
Right.
So some of these horses that, you know, the values were no different than some of the stuff that I tested in those horses, the same pre-race parameters as far as that. And I didn't do the electronic impedance, but we did, you know, the blood values. So the blood values were the same, and I'm getting dilute urine in the first loop on some of these horses. It doesn't make sense. And I know because it's a value and because there's a scale, and if you're inside or outside that scale, you're quote-unquote dehydrated or overhydrated, but it's all dependent on where you set the scale. And the scale may be set differently for some of the other things that go into what goes on in the horses in our sport. We may be outside the parameters for other normal testing.
And if you read this book from the 1800s that people are tired of hearing me talk about this, you know,
not everybody on the call may have been.
Yeah, if anybody's looking for an interesting read on the call, it's a book called Horses of the Sahara, and it's by General Damaus, D-A-M-A-U-S, and you can Google it and find it for free. You can get a PDF, you know, just Google it, and it's online for free. But it was written in 1850 by a French general who was among the French that conquered the was now like Algeria and Libya and that part of the Africa. And he, as a French cavalry officer, developed the radical notion that the Arab war horses were the best war horses in the world and the Arab tribesmen were the best equestrians in the world. And so he tried to conquer all their secrets. But the how little those horses ate and drank just boggles your mind. But obviously those horses were selected, trained, you know, campaigned, et cetera, in a unique part of the world. But it may be that our endurance horses, again, they aren't normal horses, you know.
Well, my question is, who's done most of this research? I mean, the University of Guelph, if you look at vet schools and areas where research is coming out, University of Guelph, University of Michigan and Minnesota, and some from California, but not as much, some more recently, they've done the most work in terms of exercise physiology that relates to endurance horses. I kind of maintain, if you look at a bunch of horses that from the Guelph area or maybe northern New England, you know, stuff that they would have access to, those horses have to have some fairly different parameters than horses perhaps from the southeast. And they're conditioning in different areas and so forth. So
yeah,
would that not generate if they're using normal values for horses in the northeast versus horses in the or Canadian horses versus South, could that not be enough of a variation that these horses, and again, 2 or 3 percentage points put you in the normal range and not the dehydrated range. So could that be where some of this variation comes from?
You know, it would be interesting to get Dwight Hooten's views of this because, you know, he saw horses every day for 6
right.
years in the Mideast.
Yep. And the heat, and I've got an older brother that works over there a lot, and he talks about how hot it is, but the fact that, you know, it's not like you walk out here and the next thing you know, your shirt's soaked. So heat and humidity are quite different things too, and that may factor into it as much as anything else because of what ends up happening from water loss. And does the body end up making in the Southeast, do those horses end up being different in terms of what they're doing in spleen-wise or red blood cell-wise because of the fact that they're losing, you know, blood body water just standing there sweating without even exercising on some days? So I'd be interested in doing it. It would be simple enough to go ahead and, you know, run a bunch of horses in different environments and see what the normals are from that standpoint.
Yeah,
that would
make a good study.
Pardon, I didn't hear
that. I'm sorry.
I said that would make a good study, you know, to do it. The horses in different parts of the country.
Yeah,
it's fairly straightforward, and that might help. I've got to believe that there's some variation because I saw, like everyone else, I saw too many horses that at that ride were deemed to be dehydrated that went on to do well, and we had no issues with them clinically and stuff, and I would have expected somewhere in one of those things or we would have at least had something to correlate that to. Because I would think in parameters as far as what we know in exercise physiology, dehydrated before a race does not bode well.
Yeah. At all.
No.
Well, throw it back to Rich. You did you rejoin or?
Hello.
Yeah.
Were you talking to me?
Have any questions?
Well, not directly. I just, we're supposedly doing better or learning how to better condition our horses here, but looking at the completion times of the Tevis over the years, it seems like we're getting slower for the Tevis than like about 1990 is about the point where things seem to change.
They changed the trail.
Okay, that's allowed for that much time?
Yeah, the trail got, there was a big change in the trail, and it got much slower, and it occurred in that period.
Okay.
Yeah, it used to be, as I remember, you stayed up outside the American River Canyon. Once you got through like the first 60 miles, you basically had a straight run downhill to Auburn and through areas that had been undeveloped, and that area has all got developed, and they cut a new trail that went down into the American River Canyon, and that was the first thing that slowed it down. And then after the first checkpoint, you used to be on roads into the, before you went into the two steep canyons, and instead they took that up over a ridge line and off trail. So,
well, it's just like Biltmore has gotten faster because we have had to change trail and we have a lot more flat trail.
Okay.
Where we used to have a lot more mountain climbing.
Yeah, it makes it very difficult to do retrospective studies and look at things like that.
Right, yeah. I mean, we've changed from year to year practically over the last 5 to 10 years.
I don't know if anybody's followed this, but there's been a lot of debate. I wouldn't say a lot, but there's been some debate in the last 6 months about changing the character for the Breeders' Cup because we haven't had a Breeders' Cup winner in quite a while, and people are saying that, you know, it's just too hard, and with modern horses, it's too much to ask them to come back and run 3 races in the kind of time frame it is, and people have been talking about changing the time between them. And, you know, the purists are saying, hey, that's not the way to do it because then we lose everything. We lose any kind of comparison about what's been done with horses. The fact that you're running the same distances, the same times between them, gives you a good chance to be able to look at that. That's kind of what's ruined baseball. You can't have these arguments about who would have been better the 25, 25, 25 Yankees or the, you know, 87 Cardinals. You can't have those discussions anymore with things that have gotten changing ballparks and everything else.
Right, ballpark is, and the OD is the same way. They've changed the trail numerous times in the last 10 years. So they really don't have it any more than we do. Not that we wanted to do, it's just what had to happen because we lost trail. And this happens with trails all over, everywhere.
But if you look at the winning times or the record times for 100 miles, I mean, that has come down drastically.
Oh, yeah. 3 or 4 hours.
It's huge. Absolutely.
Well, not totally.
It's come down maybe 30 minutes.
Come some,
it depends on whether or not
you believe
the numbers as far as distances from the
back
old rides, too.
J.D.'s ride, now, might have been short, but J.D.'s ride was 1:07:38 back in 1994, and the top four horses were all under 8 hours. So,
right.
Yeah. But our average time used to be closer to 13 hours, whereas now we're getting a lot of tens or less.
Yeah, and if you look at international stuff, I mean, that's where the biggest thing is coming.
Yeah.
I think most of the international courses now, you're going to assume they're all going to be relatively flat. They're all going to be pretty much a race. For me personally, I'd love to see the WEGs be done at something like Leatherwood or something, and then we'd see a little bit different variation. But you can't, you're training, and internationally they're training for a particular type of race. They know what the conditions generally are going to be, and those horses are being pointed toward a fairly flat, speedy race, and that's what we're getting now. But if you look at the times internationally, they have changed a fairly significant amount. If this kind of stuff was happening in human sport racing, it would be, the difference between a 9-something for a 100-mile to bringing it down to 6 or 7, I guess, for a 100-yard race or something. Yeah. So I think things are getting fitter. I do think we are getting fitter and faster, and certainly there's been more emphasis on training for some speed and stuff, too, overall.
I think, in some sense, very different from the original traditions of the horse.
We almost have two sports, and we have to deal with that at some point. We have endurance racing. We have
endurance in our country. Mm-hmm.
And even endurance, the reason, interesting history for those on the call who aren't aware of it, the reason the American Endurance Ride Conference was called Ride, not Race, was not because it wasn't considered a time competition. It was a time competition over tough courses. But the history of the formation was there was a lot of racing going on at basically marathon-type distances, 20 miles, 5 miles, thereabouts, and horses dying. And so the founders of AERC thought an endurance ride should be so long and so tough that people had to pace their horses. They had to ride their horses, not just get up and race like a jockey.
Yeah.
So early days of the sport, they didn't want 50-mile rides. There was a big debate about even allowing much less the 50-mile rides over flat, fast courses. The other point is, I think if you took a lot of these horses that have been specialized for the flat, fast races and asked them to do a ride like the Tevis or the Old Dominion, they wouldn't finish because they don't have the ability to handle the rough terrain and the side hill and the uphill and downhill.
Yeah, they don't have the muscle mass to pull hills and to go ahead and balance and stuff too. And you're right, but that is the ultimate of looking at a horse that is positioned, trained and conditioned for one specific purpose.
Yeah.
And we're getting, really specific, and they're doing well at that specific deal. And the overall horse is a different, different breed and different character and stuff, and you would necessarily train that horse a little bit differently. And I don't think you can do elite times on a flat race and on a hilly race or a rocky terrain race essentially with the same horse. There are probably some that can do that, but that would be the definitely not the norm.
Very few.
And you'd be lucky if you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like my horse Super, who has had a very good career, but I think if you had tried to specialize him in flat, fast racing, he would just been a very ordinary horse.
Mm-hmm. Now we can make
a
whole
case.
and mentally he might
and the rider may have also been a basket
mentally,
case.
Whether he ever would have been, probably in the sense those horses gallop with other horses every day, so you know that becomes their normal routine. So he might have mentally adjusted, but even if he mentally adjusted, I think his physical build, his strength, and all that would have was a very ordinary horse, because his strengths that enable him to be a good mountain horse are actually almost counter what you need to be a good flat galloping horse.
Yeah, you could have a whole seminar on just the conformation for the endurance horse and whether that would work or not. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So.
Sudhi, you have any other questions?
I don't. Thank you. It's been
okay.
Great.
And Rich, do you want to put anything else on the table at this stage?
No, I don't think so.
If everybody's got my email, or if you see me at rides, if you come up with anything else in terms of having some thoughts about how to progress with this or things to test, I would be all ears. And I think we'll go forward, or at least I'm going to try to go forward a little bit with this and see if we can fine-tune it a little bit. And I think that's what it's going to take. You know, the idea of applying subjective criteria, but being still specific enough to make it have some value. But I can't get past, in my mind anyway, those two slides showing the 82% with norepinephrine, not a norepinephrine, but with the best blood parameters, and then somewhere in the 70s. So if we can tap into that, I think we can probably do a better job relatively inexpensively and without having to do anything invasive. But
mm-hmm.
As you say, it's very, very enticing.
Couple things. Let me just throw on the table to think about, Ken. And
yep.
So you'll be a big South Fork, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you maybe bounce ideas around then. Occurs to me that weight may be important. I know we used to use that
weight
as
carried or weight of the animal.
The weight of the animal. In other words, we used to, one big difference between Charles' horse Strut and my horse Druven was Druven would maintain his weight. Strut would have trouble maintaining his weight, which meant we had to skip a competition with him.
Right.
So that may be something, and that's fairly easily either observed or maybe...
Sure, and that goes back to appetite and, willingness to eat after competition and stuff.
Well, the other thing that...
Strutter never lost his appetite. He just lost weight.
Yeah.
There you go. Well...
So that would be another parameter that we might be able to monitor in our horse.
Sure.
And then I don't know whether I know as a runner, an indication of how quickness and quantity of sweating, and it's something I've really never, I know an unfit horse, obviously there's a huge difference in their sweating characteristics than a fit horse, but I don't know whether our fit horses change a lot in that one or not, if they're. Sorry.
Yeah, and that's so hard to test because of environmental differences, too, But all of those things are on the table, certainly, to look at.
Okay, great. Well, that's
cool.
And I know we've sort of hit on this, but is there what you might call a path forward, in particular on the dehydration metrics? Because it seems that there's a fair amount of data that we gathered at Beltmore. There's a fair amount of data that's been gathered over the years. And has anybody actually looked to see the pre-ride stuff and see whether or not everybody's consistently dehydrated and sort of scratched their head on it?
I don't know, and that's a good question. I think we might have to look a little bit more. What I'm going to do is follow up and find out where their norms came from. What was the population that they used for their norm values?
Yeah.
And that would be what I want, and I would then try to see whether or not we have a different norm, and that would explain a whole lot. And it may be a different norm in a region. It may be a different norm at a different time of year. Certainly horses that have, gone through a hot, humid summer, are they better prepared? Are they more capable of going from what would be considered dehydrated to being well hydrated as soon as they exercise, because they're essentially sequestering more or as a blood thinner because of the heat and humidity. But that's going to be, that's kind of what I wanted to look at. And I guess I have to figure out a little bit more about where they got their values for norms and then compare that with, by doing some, you know, some hematocrits and just seeing what's there.
Yeah.
And that's the nice thing. It'd be great to go to a ride and take blood on everybody, because then after the ride you could say, okay, I want to do follow-ups on these horses because they did well and these horses that had trouble. But because we don't know that beforehand, getting the pre's are always the harder part, which is why this study was kind of interesting, because we had a lot of people sign up to get us pre's, and that helped a lot.
Yeah.
But that's what it's going to take, because if we had, you know, then we didn't have horses get in trouble, but it would really be nice to look at pre's and post's and where they were, to be able to say, does dehydration, or what we're considering dehydration, even have any relevance? So a lot more stuff that we need to look at, but I'll be able to tell you a little bit more about that, because I want to research a little bit more about where the norms come from.
Okay, great.
Sounds
cool.
I think that would be very useful.
Cool. Thank you.
Cool.
I found this great.
All right.
Thank
well, it's a great discussion to have, and like I said, next time around maybe we'll do something on how do we really train for speed, which is something I've been kind of getting more and more interested in and talking to more thoroughbred trainers. So, but it's been interesting, and I will talk to you guys probably at Big Southport.
Yeah, great.
All right, take
Thank
care.
You all very much. Thanks, everybody on the call, too.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you.